Thanks for listening to Does Not Compute. Sean and I love hearing from listeners. You can say hi on Twitter at DNCcast or by joining the Spec community Slack. You can sign up today by visiting spec.fm/slack.
It feels like it's getting closer to the end of the year.
It really does. It's kind of weird. I feel like the first 9 months of this year were just gone instantly. And so far, the last three are not gone instantly.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, especially in the consulting industry, I'm sure, you know, across the board, it's like that. But in the consulting industry, there's like a giant hurry up before the end of the year. And then suddenly all of your clients are just not there. So in a few weeks, I expect to have just an impossible time getting any sort of feedback or answers. Yet, you know, everyone wants their stuff finished up before the next year. So that's fun. I can kind of feel it coming on, that feeling of I know there's a little break coming up. And I know the clients are going to be disappearing soon. So I don't, it's like mixed feelings because I want to finish the stuff I have on, but also need a break.
Oh yeah, I get that. I mean, usually the way it seems to go is there's a big rush before Thanksgiving. Then there's nothing for like a week around Thanksgiving or a week and a half. And then there's kind of a little bump back up again right before Christmas, but nobody's ever actually around to finish anything. So it's kind of just like shooting requests out into the ether.
Well, see, I think my theory is that everyone's around and I know they're reading those emails. They just don't care enough to do anything about it because they all have the same feelings. It's like after that Thanksgiving dinner, everyone just kind of is like, all right, this is it for the year. I'm just kind of like slowly coast.
You know, Polymail automatically sends read receipts.
Oh, you know what? That's my favorite thing. Some people have mixed feelings about it. I don't have mixed feelings about it.
I love read receipts. They're super useful to me.
Yeah, they're useful for me too. I mean, when Polymail first came out, people were like, that's an invasion of privacy.
I mean, it kind of is.
I don't really
know if I care.
I guess it's similar to read receipts on the iPhone. You can turn them off, you know. If you don't want to use read receipts, you can turn those off too in Polymail.
I don't think the receiver can, though, is the problem that people have with it. So like when you're the recipient of a message, unless you disable images, because I'm assuming they use a pixel tracker.
They do, yep.
Then you can't turn that off. You have to disable images, which means you're going to get a bunch of broken emails.
Yeah, it still doesn't bother me though. I will impose my will.
Suck it up.
I'm sorry if I offended anybody, but
yep,
we're just being real.
Well, they can send you an email, and then when you reply, you'll know when they see it.
I'll know when they become offended immediately. That's fine. That's fine. I've been using Polymail for quite a while and it's pretty okay. I like for client stuff, it's really nice, especially when you're working with clients or multiple people or a team of people and it takes them longer to respond. It's kind of nice to know when your stuff is being read at least. So that way when my project manager checks in and say, hey, have you heard anything back? I'm like, no, but they've read, you know, what I sent them. So I can expect something. It's easier for me to keep other people in the loop, I suppose.
Yeah, totally. I have the same feelings on it. I think it's just a useful tool and it, you know, it's just not that big of a deal to my mind, at least. I don't mind if people know when I read their messages.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, some people, I can see where they're coming from, where they might not like it. Cause I know that it puts a weird kind of social pressure on you. Like if you know that someone knows you read something and then you're suddenly feeling this pressure to have to respond. And it's not necessarily the act of responding that's difficult. It's like the expectation, like the social expectation that you know you're supposed to respond, if that even makes sense. I've heard people talk about that. Like doing small things is really hard for them because it's just the act. It's not like having to do something, but it's like the social responsibility around it, which is jarring to them.
Yeah, I can see that. Definitely makes sense. I do really like Polymail though, just separately from the read receipts. It's I don't know, for me, I find it so nice to have the same client on desktop and mobile.
Yeah, I use it too. Do you use any of like the scheduling features?
Like the read later kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do that a lot. I try to not let stuff sit in my inbox that isn't actually actionable. That's one of the things that I always really liked about Mailbox, is that I could have only stuff that I could actively work on in my inbox, because I kind of use my inbox as a to-do list a lot of times. So I that's a super helpful thing for me. It's like sometimes I'll get an email that says, I don't know, maybe I need to make a DNS change because some service has changed how you interact with them, whatever. That's a contrived example, but they say, okay, you need to do this by this date, then I'll snooze it to a week before that date and then just kind of not think about it again.
I should probably start using that.
It's not bad. It's not bad.
I just delete stuff all the time. That's all I do. I either like put it in a folder, delete it, or just let it sit in the inbox, I guess. But yeah, it has a lot of nice features I don't use. I haven't really thought about using them. But it's, again, maybe it's one of those things where Dropbox paper works for me because it's literally all I do is just put a list in it. That's it. There's nothing else. I don't have to learn how to do anything. I don't have to, you know, think about notifications and all that stuff. I don't know. It's the end of the year, Paul.
It is the end of the year, that's for sure. I'm looking at my Read Later box right now, and at the moment I have two things in there. One of them is, they're both related to something that has been ordered, actually. One of them is just an order for work that I need to follow up on next week, just to make sure that it's all gone through correctly. And the other one is just a personal order that I need to make sure ships before I move. Otherwise, I need to change the address. So I just put those in for like the appropriate dates, and then I don't have to think about them again, and they'll just kind of reappear.
Yeah, I should do that.
It's pretty great.
So what else has been going on? You've been, I know you've been doing lots of like planning and stuff for next year, but yeah, what else have you been up to?
I mean, most of my stuff has been actually getting into developer relations things a little bit. I was originally hired on as developer relations, but I kind of ended up doing a lot of actual programming work and stuff at Imagix for internal projects and all that kind of stuff. So I've actually been kind of getting to do some of the developer relations things, working on talks and working on more community related stuff. And that's been really cool. I've been enjoying that for sure.
So in like working on talks, you mean like coming up with your own presentations and then submitting them to conferences?
Yep. Yeah, basically working on abstracts to send through as proposals and then actually building out those talks with slides and my own personal notes and stuff like that. It's definitely been an interesting experience so far.
Interesting in that it's like something new for you, or interesting in that you're having to learn new things for that?
I think interesting mostly in that it feels weird to be spending a lot of my time writing instead of writing English words instead of writing code.
Sure.
It's definitely a very different mental space to be in, even though I'm writing about the same kind of topics I would normally be writing code on.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess it's kind of no different really than the switch from front end to back end for a lot of people, where it's just using the same muscles, same brain muscles, but in a slightly different way, I guess.
No, that totally makes sense. Actually, maybe 3 days ago, I got a phone call from a recruiter, and they were just checking in on a friend of mine that's looking around, and they just wanted to make sure that he had the skills he said he had or claimed he had. So they're asking me, and that was something that came up, was one of the pointed questions they asked were, you know, aside from programming and programming languages, how is communication? More specifically, are they able to intelligently communicate what they're thinking, features they're working on? Are they able to, you know, break things into metaphors so that they can help other people understand? I thought it was a really great question because that's such an important part of what we do. I mean, obviously we write programming languages, but really, you know, the other half of that is communicating with other programmers, communicating with project managers, communicating with designers, communicating even in documentation in the code, you know, what we're doing, what we're thinking, and how things work. I just kind of sat there and thought about it for a while, how important of a skill that is, because I've interviewed developers before, and it's interesting, you know, when you talk to someone that you can tell they're a talented developer, but they just don't have the best communication skills.
Yeah. I mean, this is something that's actually come up in the spec Slack a few times. I know Bryn and I have talked with people about this. And basically kind of what it comes down to for me is that really this job is more about translation than it is about anything else. It's really a huge part of it is about taking ideas that might not be worded quite correctly or thought out all the way, and then figuring out how to actually translate those into something that is a working application. And that can be for designers and developers, I think, because, you know, designers just receive the application needs to do this thing, and they need to figure out what exactly that means. What screens does it need? What needs to be on each of those screens? How are we going to lay that out in a way that makes sense to users when they're seeing this for the very first time and haven't thought about this problem for months? And then developers are the same thing. I mean, it's a lot of thinking about, it's not just the actual putting pixels in a canvas or putting code to make a web page show up. Anybody can learn that stuff. But the communication aspect of it is, I think, what really makes somebody a great designer or a great developer, being able to clearly communicate, not just with other people that do that same set of work, but with project managers, with people requesting features, with customers. I think that's such a critical skill for sure.
I've never actually heard anyone use the term translation like that in the context of programming, but that makes a lot of sense because we're working with different languages and we're working with different people that have different understandings of different languages. And so essentially you are the translator between the computer and design languages, you know, being like HTML, CSS, or even just a PSD canvas. And you're the translator to the different managers or the different even developers, which that's a really solid analogy, I think. And that also goes to show how, I mean, we've talked about it in the past, how terminology is important, using the right words at the right times in the right context. But that also kind of underscores that fact, because I've been working with another person, just pair programming with them on their front end skills, and they'll use terms interchangeably, and then I'll have to correct them and be like, that's not exactly what that means. And so if you were communicating with someone else that didn't understand where you at currently, they would be very confused by what you said. Even though it makes sense in your mind, they would not be able to understand that. And so I think that's one of the hardest things in especially learning how to program or growing in a new area in programming, is learning the proper terminology and when to use it, so that way you can actually communicate with other people that are familiar with it.
Yeah, terminology is super important, not even just for communication with other people directly, but I found it's also really important for learning. Because until you know a lot of the terminology, it's really hard for you to even look things up because you don't know what to Google. Once you know what to Google, let's say you start off learning PHP. If you don't really know what an array is, and then you decide you want to learn another language, and you're like, I know that thing that I use in PHP, I know what it does, it's like a list of stuff, but I don't know the right word for it.
Right.
Then when you go to Google that, if for learning another language, like JavaScript, you wouldn't even know what to put in the search engine. And that's something that I certainly struggled with when I was initially learning, is because I would know the thing I needed to accomplish, but not know the words to look up to just find the technical implementation of it. And that seems like such a silly problem to run into, but I mean, words really do define in a lot of ways what we can think about and how we're able to express ourselves. And if you can't write a good search query, it's going to be really hard to find the answer to your question.
Right. It's kind of like if your language didn't have a word for something and you're trying to describe that thing to somebody else, it's kind of impossible. You kind of have to, I guess at that point you could use adjectives to describe something, but you can't necessarily do that with programming very well. There's things that you could use to relate, and maybe Google might be smart enough to give you an answer. But yeah, you're right. Unless you don't know what to call something, you can't do any research on it.
Right. If you don't know what a for loop is, you know you need to do something over and over in your code, but you don't know for loop. You're not. What are you going to Google? How to do something over and over in code? that's a really it's a tough spot, and it's a weird problem for sure. But I think kind of a major one, and that's actually one of the things that I really love about the simplified JavaScript jargon dictionary. That I think we've mentioned this on the show a long time ago, but I still recommend this to people all the time. It's so great. For anybody who doesn't know what that is, it's essentially just a big old list of a bunch of JavaScript terms with a one or two sentence explanation and then a link to a deeper explanation. And so it makes it really easy when you see these terms that you don't know yet to kind of go in there and get a quick overview that will help solidify it in your mind, I think, a lot. And I've recommended this to several people who are newer to programming, and it's been super helpful for all of them, I think.
Yeah, I remember talking about this. I should actually pass this on. One thing I really like, actually, I'm noticing now is that it's just like a grab bag of everything, down to like singular things like Ajax. This is what it is. Even to like, I mean, I noticed the main stack, which would be like MongoDB, Express, Angular, and Node, right? So it covers so many things, even like packages, Mocha, Metalsmith. But one thing I just noticed right now, that it covers patterns as well, which I think is pretty cool. Like it has a succinct description of the observer pattern and prototype patterns, and that's really cool. I'm going to have to check in on this. But that's one thing that I've been thinking a lot about actually yesterday. So I was just thinking about how can I kind of step up my game. So one thing that I noticed between like self-taught programmers, and this isn't always the case, but one thing I noticed between self-taught programmers and people that have kind of like an academic background is that the people with the academic background seem to have a lot of not necessarily fancier terms, but they're, how am I trying to describe this? There's like, there's a difference in how they talk about things, right? Does that make sense, Paul?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it really is just a more academic way about of talking about things, I think.
Right. So my knowledge comes from Googling and reading articles, and then someone will suggest something and I'll say, oh yeah, I read an article and this is kind of the gist of it, right? Whereas someone with an academic background might actually be like, oh, I read a textbook, you know, and sat in on lectures. And to me, I don't know. It's like, again, it's not across the board always like this, but I've been wanting to step up my game in, I feel like filling some of the cracks in my foundation a little bit, you know, with more like more kind of like CS things. Like, for example, you know, if you go to someone who has been through school and ask them what technically is a bubble sort versus someone that's taught like a self-taught front-end developer, they might have heard the term. I'm sure they've read an article about crappy interviews that mentions it, but they wouldn't technically know what it is. Is that just a terrible example, or that's the only thing I can think of right now to describe?
No, I mean, I think that's a pretty classic problem, especially with algorithms in particular, is that you don't, I think very few people, if any, who are self-taught start out by learning CS basics and learning about algorithms and learning about different, you know, big O notation and sorting methods and all that kind of stuff. That's not how normal people would approach learning on their own, but that is how a lot of CS classes are taught. So, I mean, I'm not sure. I think for a lot of jobs, for many jobs that people have in, especially, you know, simple web app kind of dev, whether that's front end or back end, even stuff like Rails, I'm not certain how much it really matters to know a lot of that stuff, especially when you're getting started. But there is definitely is a point where you get to, and it's like, okay, yeah, it would probably be pretty good for me to understand this stuff a little bit better.
Right. And it kind of goes hand in hand with on-demand learning for so long. You kind of like, that's what you're learning about because there's so much there to learn. And then once you get to a point where you can build web applications, you can build, you know, single page JavaScript applications, then you get to a point. So where like, okay, where do I go from here? So I can keep learning the fad frameworks that come out, you know, and keep kind of just keep myself busy with that, or I can take a step back and use what I know for a while. And that's kind of where I'm at now is I can, you know, I can make SPAs, I can make Rails apps, I can make Node.js apps, I can do that. And now I feel like where my weakest point is actually the lower level stuff, the stuff that I never really needed to learn because it never came up. So yeah, anyway, I found a good resource called 4 Semesters of CS by Brian Holt. And I believe he currently works at Netflix. But it's actually a super good, succinct article where he talks about, you know, the importance of CS concepts like big O and recursion and different sorting algorithms. And again, this is stuff I'd never needed to know. So I never looked it up. If I needed to sort something, then I just pulled in Lodash, you know, I never had to do any of this stuff on my own, but I feel maybe it's insecurity talking and knowing like people that are around my age group or on my experience level and knowing that they know certain things that I don't, and I'm wanting to pick up on that and add that to my experience as well. But that's kind of where I'm at, you know, just I never needed to learn this stuff. It didn't concern me before. And I feel like now it might. So I need to apply that to my knowledge.
Sure. I mean, that's kind of a classic fallacy though, is to think that everybody knows everything that you know, right, plus more, when that's just really not the case. You know a lot of unique stuff. You have unique experience that many other people don't. Even people who have more experience with actual algorithmic comp sci kind of things.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the case. There's people that I look at and I just assume that they know everything that I know and plus whatever they're talking about at the time.
Right.
I guess there's also a certain like mystique about it. So I'll go perusing through GitHub repos and then I'll see someone say like, oh, this is this whatever algorithm from whatever. And they'll link to like a Wikipedia article. And I'm like, I don't know what that even means, but they're using it to solve this problem in a cool and efficient way. So maybe that's where some of it's coming from too, is like a wanting to have those tools at my disposal.
Yeah. I mean, kind of my technique for that has always just been, if somebody does link to a wiki article or something about a thing that I don't understand, I just read it. And then at least I'm not going to have a complete understanding of it. It's certainly not right away, but at least it will it plants that seed and kind of locks the concept in and what it might be used for into my head. And then when I run into a problem later down the road, a lot of times I'll think, oh, you know what? I'll use your example of a bubble sort. Maybe a bubble sort would be the right way to solve this problem. Just because after reading it, you really do kind of lock things in. You won't retain all of it. You won't remember how to write the most efficient bubble sort after reading the Wikipedia article. Like, that's just not going to happen. But you will kind of learn what it's useful for and why you might use it over a quick sort or something else. And that's just going to make you a slightly better programmer. And again, that comes down to knowing what to Google. If you don't even know what a sorting algorithm is, you're not going to be able to figure that out.
Yeah, I mean, I've been able to make it so far using map and reduce and filter, the three, you know, my three main go-tos, map, reduce, and filter. I can build almost anything with those. It's just one of those weird things where it is, you know, it's the end of the year, it's going to be a new year. It's like it's also one of those things where I am getting older, so I'm thinking like, okay, well, I don't think I would be able to just quit my job and go back on tour next year if I wanted to. I'm old enough to know that's probably a bad idea. So maybe it's just me wanting to take programming a little bit more serious, like take the seriousness up a notch, if that makes sense. But to me, it's always been like programming is how I'm making money and I enjoy it and it's cool, but there's always other things that I could also want to do. And so it's one of those weird things where you're almost afraid to totally submerge yourself in it because you feel like you might lose another part of you, if that makes sense, which is getting pretty philosophical here. But
no, I absolutely get that 100%. I mean, that's something that I think about a lot, but I also have no other marketable skills.
I don't think that's true. You make a pretty good whiskey sour from what I hear.
Could be a bartender.
Yeah. But I think that's kind of what has been drifting through my mind and what I've been thinking about is trying to take that up a step and then realizing that like that doesn't mean I have to forget about guitar. That doesn't mean I have to forget about lifting or exercising or whatever else. It's just a balance. And that's one thing that I've always kind of struggled with in my life is I get into something and I get really into it and it's hard for me to maintain a balance in other things. And so I feel like if I shift balance to something else, then that means that another priority has to leave. And again, this is, you know, me personally, and if someone else identifies with that, awesome. But maybe that's something a little early to be talking about resolutions, but that's something I can identify that I need to work on is applying proper balance, especially over long periods of time. Because it's easy to shift balance, you know, for weeks at a time. But when it comes to months, it's much more difficult to do that.
What a weird, philosophical episode. I like it. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of Does Not Compute. If you enjoy the show, don't forget to rate or review us on iTunes. It just takes a minute and is one of the easiest ways to help new listeners find the show.